Welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, your daily podcast of the top education headlines from across the web. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Susie.
Good morning and welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with the original April Fools, Susie Brooks and Mike Bronder. We're happy to be here today reading out the top headlines in K-12 education news so you don't have to. Today, our top stories are going to include Wisconsin is set to offer a free driver's education. We're going to dive into how Sal Khan uses AI. That's by Eric Ofgang from Tech and Learning. There's a game changer for kinship care families in Kentucky. And let's see how going back to the SAT could set colleges' student diversity programs back, and that is by Joseph Soares. But to kick us off with the rest of today's headlines, here is Susie Brooks.
Good morning, Michael. I'm so glad to be here and so glad you're back. You were missed last week. And looking here at our news feed, there are no shortage of stories that we can share with our listeners today. Starting off with the Education Exchange. Does a federal tax credit scholarship bill have a chance to become law? The Educational Choice for Children Act is gaining support in Congress, but many obstacles lie ahead. So you can check out that post. It's coming from Education Next. And let's see, also from Education Next, from Dan Seforian-Buten, there is an article that talks about there are no shortcuts to thinking. A teacher sees promise in the way that students are already using AI as a learning tool. And then finally, one that I was going to read out, but you'll have to check it out on your own, is coming from us from Yesenia Robles from Chalkbeat. And it talks about how apps are helping teachers communicate with families that don't speak English. And that preview goes on to say Emma Gonzalez Gutierrez has struggled to communicate with the teachers of her 5 children for years. She's tried to stay engaged, but she's attended meetings and gravitated towards Spanish-speaking staff and relied on translators, including her kids, over the years. So you'll have to listen in on or read more to learn about what some of those apps are. But now I'm going to dive in deeper on the story out of Wisconsin that talks about free driver education for students in need, which intrigued me because I remember how expensive driver's ed is. Wisconsin Act 86 makes $6 million available to driver's education, and this is written by Princess Sophia Byers, and it's from the Wisconsin Watch. As the director of Pathways High in Milwaukee, Franz Meyer has students asking him about driver's education opportunities almost daily. He said students want to learn to drive, but options are limited and often unaffordable. I'd tell him you can go to this place, but they only have so many slots, or you can go here, but it costs $350, Meyer said, but it clearly wasn't enough. Some young people just have to take the risk and drive anyway. He said the cost of driver's education courses range from $100 to $400. Help may soon be available. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation, or WISDOT, is expected to roll out a free program that would provide driver's education for Wisconsin high school students in need. Wisconsin Act 86, which was signed by Governor Tony Evers in early December, makes $6 million available for driver's education. According to the Wisconsin Department of Administration's fiscal estimate, from 10,000 to 13,300 students will be eligible to receive driver's education grants under the program. That's pretty awesome. The grants are a result of Common Ground's 3-year campaign, which started after a listening session the group held in 2021. Common Ground is a nonpartisan organization that allows residents to identify problems in the community and then find solutions. Jennifer O'Hear, the lead organizer and executive director of Common Ground, said funds are expected to be available by July. Officials from Wisconsin Department of Transportation declined to comment on when the funds will be available and how students and their families can access them for driver's education. They said the program is in the development stage. O'Hear said Common Grounds heard 982 people say reckless driving was their number one concern. We had many incidents around the area, Milwaukee, Sherman Park, where the young people are getting in cars and not knowing how to drive and causing accidents, said Frank Finch, a Common Ground leader involved in the campaign. As the conversation evolved from hearing residents' concerns to creating solutions, Common Ground leaders pointed to drivers' education as a tool to address reckless driving. According to OHEAR, Wisconsin funded drivers' education from 1961 until 2004. However, the state still requires youths under 18 to enroll in a school or commercial driving program in order to get a learner's permit and probationary license. We learned that there's a whole generation of kids out there that don't know how to drive because they never had access to driver's education, Finch said. Pathway High's mayor, who had been in his position for 6 years, participated in the campaign along with several of his students. One of his students, Shankayla Caldwell, said that the cost of driver's ed created challenges for her. "I had been struggling to find access to driver's ed, and it had been kind of hard because of the prices," she said. "Like, I really, really wanted to drive, and I know I can't go without my license, so it's just been a lot of waiting." According to a 2016 University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Employment and Training Institute study, the most recent data available, only 30% of 18-year-olds in Milwaukee have a driver's license compared to 66% of 18-year-olds statewide. Additionally, only 30% of African American and Hispanic 18-year-olds hold a driver's license compared to 75% of white 18-year-olds. Wow. Through the community listening sessions, Common Ground leaders identified the need for long-term funding for driver's education for students as a way to combat reckless driving. OHEAR and Finch said the campaign got rolling when they met Andy Franken, the president of the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance. The group, which represents the property and casualty insurance industry, advocates and advances policy for those groups. Once I saw the specific stories and studies about Milwaukee and statewide, I knew that this was a cause worth being involved in, Franken said. And so this article first appeared on Wisconsin Watch and was republished here on the 74, which is where I was reading it from. But you can check it out to revisit and read more. And I think that's an awesome program. Those percentages were surprising to me as I read through them. Thanks for listening, Mike. What do you have?
Thanks, Susie. And of course, mobility is a big factor in underprivileged communities, and very happy to hear about that program serving that community. So that's
It's
great.
awesome.
Yeah, great stuff. Let's see. We have ed tech show and tell for April from Tech and Learning, new ed tech products that have caught the tech and learning editor's eyes, bound to be interesting. And you can find a link to that on Tech and Learning itself or on our news feed here at K-12 Leaders. Senator Bill Cassidy out of Louisiana is hitting pandemic learning loss head on. And Frederick Hess from Education Next dives into that story. You can find that on Education Next or here on K-12 Leaders. Let's see, Laura Ascione from eSchool News has a really interesting article, Five Educators Sharing Insights into Teaching and Learning. This is no doubt answering a lot of the questions we have about common practices or perhaps uncommon practices in the K-12 classroom. I'd encourage you to check that out on eSchool News, where you can find a link to Laura's article here on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And one thing that really caught my eye this morning, Susie, was an article by Eric Ofgang from Tech and Learning on our friend Sal Khan, how Sal Khan is using AI to teach. I think it's worth diving into this, and especially given all of the activity here on K-12 Leaders and conversation around effective use of AI in the classroom. And this is again by Eric Ofgang from Tech and Learning. Sal Khan has embraced AI to help support Khan Academy, but he also uses it in his own teaching practice. When Sal Khan first got access to an advanced AI large language model, like many edtech enthusiasts, he couldn't get enough of it. There's the early adopter crowd, the techno-curious crowd, Khan says. When we first got access to the technology, we didn't sleep. We just kept playing with it. Khan's early use of AI encouraged him to embrace it, GPT-4 technology helps power Kamingo, an AI tutor from his free online platform, Khan Academy. Khan believes these types of AI tutors can revolutionize the way writing is taught and many other aspects of education. But at the same time, his personal use of AI has evolved. He's spending less time playing with the tool and more time using it in specific ways to help prepare for the education videos he still makes for Khan Academy. Here is how Khan uses it as an educator himself. First, Khan uses AI to help him prepare to make educational videos in two key ways. One is to explore deeper conceptual questions he has, and many students might also have, about topics videos are addressing. Second, Khan uses it for ideation. For instance, he says if he's looking for books on a given topic and can come up with a few titles, he might ask an AI tool for more information. The first use is what he typically finds most helpful. He believes a key to his success is his ability to ask questions during his videos that anticipate questions students might have. This grew out of his own lifelong intellectual curiosity. Maybe some teachers get annoyed by me when I was a kid, got annoyed by me when I was a kid. I would ask the educated question, "Hey, if that's true, wouldn't this be true?" Khan says. When planning his videos, Khan explores conceptual questions that he might already know the answer to, as well as ones he's unsure of and needs to explore before filming. A good large language model can be the perfect tool to test these types of questions and can lead to deeper learning in the process, he says. A recent example of how Khan uses AI to explore conceptual questions came when he was preparing for a video and trying to understand why supernovas explode. Though he knew the basics, he couldn't quite visualize why the death of a star would lead to an outward explosion. So he asked Khanmigo. Instead of providing a Wikipedia-style answer, it asked him what he already knew. Khan told the AI that he knew the basics but didn't quite understand why a star that had essentially ran out of fuel would explode. "I would think it would collapse if you had all the fusion stopping," Khan explained to the AI when prompted. The AI told him he wasn't wrong, but asked several questions, encouraging him to think more about that collapse and what collapsing entails. "Have you ever seen anything that falls quickly without bouncing?" the AI asked. Khan responded, "Oh, so you're telling me that it collapses so quickly that it is essentially compresses the core and then it rebounds?" The AI said, "Yes, that's exactly what's going on." That led to an aha moment for Khan, and after that, the exchange, he had a better picture of what caused a supernova. The type of conceptual insight is what Khan believes AI is so well positioned to do for educators and their students. "I've done web searches on this. I've read articles from NASA," he says. "I didn't quite get the conceptual understanding that I got with this 10-minute conversation that I had with the AI." Ultimately, like so much in education, getting the most out of AI interaction is all about asking good questions to create a useful dialogue. And that is by Eric Ofgang from Tech and Learning. If you have questions about that, you're welcome to ask them here on k12leaders.com/breakdown. You can find that article republished here along with a discussion thread around it. And we'd love to hear what you all have to say. So thanks for that. And Susie, back to you.
Awesome. That was a good one too. I was very curious about our friend Sal. All right, let's see. You left off. Oh, all right. Vague school rules. I can see above here. Vague school rules at the root of millions of school suspensions. This one's coming out of the Hechinger report, and students miss hundreds of thousands of days of school each year for subjective infractions like defiance and disorderly conduct. So to read a little bit more about that, you can check that one out. And coming at us from Virginia Mercury, we have Virginia adopts regulatory changes for special education amid federal review. Since 2019, Virginia has been under ongoing investigation by the U.S. Department of Education, which previously determined that the state repeatedly failed to resolve complaints filed by parents and did not have reasonably designed procedures and practices to ensure a timely resolution process for those complaints. So that sounds like a doozy of an article to check out. And that brings me to my second focus of the day, which talk about game changer. This one's talking about the game changer for kinship care families, and that's sailing out of Kentucky legislature. This one is written by Sarah Ladd for the Kentucky Lantern. So it goes on to say, long-awaited financial help will be coming to kinship care. Kentuckians who are raising a minor relative, such as a grandchild or a niece, thanks to a bill that received unanimous approval in the House Friday. Senate Bill 151 now heads to Government Andy Beshear's desk for a signature or veto. It passed the Senate in early February. Norma Hatfield, president of the Kinship Families Coalition of Kentucky, hailed the bill's passage as a game changer for a lot of families in the future. The bill allows kinship caregivers to change their placement status from temporary custody to a child-specific foster home, a change that will come with financial assistance, as the Lantern previously reported. It will also let children being removed from homes list their potential preferred caregivers, allowing them more say in their placements. I love that. Representative Samara Hebron, brought the Senate bill to the House floor. The bill, she said, is all about giving kinship care to families in Kentucky more flexibility. This flexibility will close the services, supports, and resource gap that is currently plaguing many of the families, she said. Hatfield, who has been raising two grandchildren for nearly a decade, is a longtime champion of the kinship families and renewed her push for help from the legislature this year. She told the Lantern on Friday that the bill's passage was hugely emotional. She said she cried in the House gallery as the bill was approved. The fact that both chambers passed the measure unanimously says very clearly this needed to happen, she said, and it's the right thing to do. I mean, there's just absolutely no doubt anywhere. Terry Brooks, executive director of Kentucky's Youth Advocates, said final passage of HB 151 means thousands of Kentucky's kinship and fictive kin families flat out won today. Just as these caregivers step up at the moment's notice to provide a safe space for their young loved ones to grow and heal, our General Assembly has stepped up once again to prioritize the well-being of these children who have experienced abuse or neglect, Brooks said. Still, work remains, Hatfield said. She's closely watching a House resolution that, if passed, would establish a kinship care task force. Members would study kinship in Kentucky and submit findings by December 1st, which Hatfield said could provide needed data revealing needs facing kinship caregivers. I'm hoping that the study will clearly identify these things, educate the legislators as well, educate the public, and then we can start working on the rest of the supports that are needed for these families that are kind of caught in the gap that they don't have anything, she said. I have high hopes for that. It's interesting. I had never heard of the term kinship care before this morning, so that was why I went ahead and grabbed this article just to learn how they're supporting families that are different than a traditional one. I think that's awesome. I hope it goes through.
And Susie, I think you're touching on one of the real powerful things that we're doing here, with the breakdown, and that is, exposing ourselves to new ideas that are maybe tangential to our daily experience or our daily responsibilities in our schools, but ultimately broadening our perspectives and I think improving us, improving how we are actually prepared to serve our students and our communities. So thanks for drawing our attention to that.
You're welcome. What do you have?
Let's see. So elsewhere in the headlines, there are questions on Chalkbeat from district administration about Chicago school board members being paid, and the education advocates who are in favor of that are renewing a push to change Illinois law to allow Chicago school board members to receive a stipend, with the hope that would encourage teachers and parents from low-income households to represent Chicago Public Schools' diverse student body. Fascinating initiative there in Chicago to try to increase the diversity on their school board. You had mentioned already, Wisconsin's is set to offer free driver education to students in need. And then let's see, from the Learning Network, we have a couple of updates from the New York Times Learning Network. The word of the day is tenuous, which has appeared in 175 articles on the New York Times in the past year. That is the word tenuous. And let's see, they also, the Learning Network has published their 7th annual student podcast contest. That may be interesting for your students and would encourage you to check that out on the Learning Network on the New York Times. And I think wrapping it up today for our final story is another article on standardized testing and college admissions. This from The Conversation. And let's see how going back to the SAT could set back college student diversity. Earlier this year, a number of colleges announced they were going back to using the SAT and the ACT. Joseph Soares, a professor of sociology, expert on higher education, and proponent of test optional admissions, answers a few questions about the rationale behind the college's decision to require applicants to submit scores from standardized college admissions tests. And this article, no doubt, will be in juxtaposition to a number of the articles we've already cited here on the breakdown around diverse communities requesting that standardized testing come back into the district. So this will be an interesting article. So the primary question, are SAT requirements making a comeback? No. As of early 2024, just four schools announced the return of mandatory testing: Brown, Dartmouth, Yale, and MIT. Meanwhile, many other schools are sticking with test optional admissions. These schools include Boston University, Columbia, Cornell, the University of Michigan, University of Missouri, University of Utah, Vanderbilt, and William and Mary. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic in 2019, there were approximately 1,050 test optional schools out of approximately 2,300 bachelor's degree granting institutions, not counting four-year for-profit schools. But today, in 2024, there are over 1,900 test optional or test-free schools. Nationally, test optional is still the norm. Why are these schools going back to it? The four schools that have gone back to standardized tests had initially dropped their requirement because of the pandemic. The College Board put its test administrations on pause during the pandemic because testing sites could not host them. Now, administrators at Yale and Dartmouth say that some students from low-income families were harmed by not submitting test scores. Their argument is that by submitting test scores, it would have enabled colleges to find youths of promise from low-income families. The assumption is that students from an under-resourced high school without an abundance of extracurricular opportunities or AP courses will perhaps have a strong test score that will signal their potential. Does their story check out? And again, this is the author Joseph Soares. I don't believe the facts support the claims being made by the four universities that decided to reinstate the SAT. After going test optional, the Ivy League and MIT had more racial and economic diversity than ever before. Taking 2018 as a pre-pandemic benchmark, when test requirements were more common, and 2022 as a year of test optional admissions by these schools, we can see the largest increase in the Ivy League's history in underrepresented Black and Hispanic students came while being test optional. In 2018, there were 72,654 undergraduates in the Ivies plus MIT. In 2022, there were 74,258 undergraduates, an aggregate increase of 1,604 students. Black and Hispanic students accounted for 79% of the total growth. The number of Black and Hispanic undergraduates went up at those nine schools by a total of 1,261, according to Joseph Soares' analysis of figures from the U.S. Department of Education's Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System. The number of Pell Grant students who are widely treated as a proxy for students from low-income families went up at six schools, remained the same at one, and declined slightly at two. His Sora's unpublished analysis found. This suggests that the numbers of students from low-income families also increased overall, although not on the same scale as increases in Black and Hispanic students. So, what research are the schools relying on? Dartmouth has issued a study that explains why it decided to resurrect a test score requirement. It reported that being test optional produced a 35% increase in applicants and that 31% of all enrolled students at Dartmouth were admitted without a test score. Of those applicants evaluated without reference to a test score, they afterward were able to get scores for 19% of them. They found higher admission rates for disadvantaged students whose unknown SAT scores were actually under 1400 than those with scores above 1400, 82% versus 18% respectively. The school saw this as a bad policy because it believes that higher scoring disadvantaged students will have higher GPAs and brighter careers than lower scoring ones. It drew the conclusion that requiring all to submit a test score was better for quality admissions than allowing students to decide on their own whether to submit their scores. We're going to come back to that in just one second. And this is worth reading on your own because there is a lot going on in those couple short paragraphs. Of those applicants evaluated without reference to a test score, they afterward were able to get scores for 19% of them. They found higher admission rates for disadvantaged students whose unknown SAT scores were actually under 1400 than those with scores above 1400. The school saw this as bad policy because it believes that higher scoring disadvantaged students will have higher GPAs and brighter careers than lower scoring ones. It drew the conclusion that requiring all to submit a test score was better for quality admissions than allowing students to decide on their own whether to submit their scores. There is a lot in that single paragraph.
I know you read it twice, and I can agree. Wow.
So just the fact that Dartmouth, the school in question, is anticipating and predicting the career potential of a 18-year-old applicant as grounds for admission, I think is fascinating, right? That it's not about giving students opportunities, it's about riding on the coattails of students who they think have high potential.
Right.
Right, so that's I'm sorry, I'm flat-footed. I am flat-footed. And perhaps very naive. So
Did it say how long they've been going without using the test scores? How long they've tried this for?
it is just the 2 points in time, right?
Okay.
2018 and 2022. So over the 4 years immediately before and just following the pandemic. Well, so this article wraps up with a summary of what it means for campus diversity when highly selective schools, some refer to these as highly rejective schools, went test optional, diversity went up on their campuses. My research suggests that the resumption of standardized tests will diminish the number of applicants from Black and Hispanic students from low-income families. I want to encourage you all to find this article on k12leaders.com/breakdown. You can find that link to the conversation. And again, this is published by Joseph Soares, who's a professor of sociology at Wake Forest, and really is a fascinating treatment of this issue. We'd love to hear what you have to think. And you're welcome to join the conversation here at k12leaders.com/breakdown. And we'd really love to hear your perspective on this.
Absolutely. I think that one took us by surprise. Oh, so that brings us to the end of another episode. Yeah, we're here every weekday morning being able to talk about what's going on in education news and sharing it with all of you because we know it's super important and you don't always have the time to read it yourself. So we read the news aloud so you don't have to. So I'm Susie Brooks.
Not Mike Bronder.
And we hope that you have a great day at school and that you escape getting tricked by an April Fool's joke.
Thanks, everybody.